Thank you very much, Mr. Marks. Good afternoon, everyone. Very nice to see you all. It's a very nice day as well. It's the last day of unleavened bread. When we look at the days of unleavened bread, there's a lot of biblical events associated with the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You know, different people might have differing opinions as to what was the most important. You might consider that the exodus from slavery in Egypt, which took place immediately after the Passover during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, was maybe the greatest event to have happened during the Spring Festival. We might view the crossing of the Red Sea, traditionally assigned to the last day of unleavened bread that we're celebrating today, as another of these great festival events. After all, this crossing signified that Israel was at last, long last, finally free from Egyptian domination. Freedom was then a reality for them. 40 years later, after Israel entered the Promised Land, the miraculous conquest of Jericho took place over 7 days of this same Feast of Unleavened Bread. There were other great unleavened bread events that involved rededicating Israelites to their Creator. Reforms led by King Hezekiah and other reforms later on brought by King Josiah. These all happened, particularly accumulated in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And they were times when God's people at that time recommitted themselves to Him. In the New Testament, there is another great event that took place during the days of unleavened bread that's much greater in its impact than any of those events. That event was the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which took place halfway through the Feast of Unleavened Bread. I think if we'd lived at that time, we were followers of Jesus in Jerusalem at the time of his crucifixion, and then we were told that he'd been resurrected, I'm sure we'd all be thinking that that was the greatest event to have ever taken place in the history of humanity. And, of course, we would have been right. In the Old Testament, the Messiah was still to come. Today I want to take a look at the events that took place in Egypt at that time, when the average Israelite had very little knowledge of a coming Messiah. I will be looking at the time and events leading up to the exodus of the Israelites out of Egypt and beyond. And I want really to try to get into the mind, as it were, of the average Israelite living through these events, and then see how the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ have influenced the focus of these events. So we'll do that today as we consider the meaning of the days of unleavened bread. Today is the last day of unleavened bread, and it's on this day that we believe that the people of Israel crossed the Red Sea and finally set foot on the land that wasn't under the control of Egypt. Crossing a sea, waters dividing, allowing millions of people to cross over is clearly a great miracle. Most people today would no doubt cast dates on this actually happening. The people in the world in general, as it would clearly need to be a supernatural event to take place, the way the Bible said it did. And really, supernatural miracles from a creator God, they're not really very popular in today's world. However, the New Testament writers clearly had no problem with this. Twice in the New Testament, in Acts and in the book of Hebrews, the writers say that the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. And word got around also to the neighbouring nations at the time of the event. 40 years after it happened, when the Israelites were about to come into the Promised Land, finally, and spies were sent to the city of Jericho, they met Rahab, who in fact helped them to escape the spies that were there in the city. And she shows clearly what was happening was well known to the people of Jericho. If we turn first to Joshua chapter 2. Joshua chapter 2. We hear an account of this. Joshua 2, and if we go to verse 9, and she, that's Rahab, said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that your terror has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you. They knew about that when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side of Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. So this clearly shows that the people of Jericho were aware of this great miracle of God 40 years after the event. The events surrounding the crossing of the Red Sea were actually out of the control of the Israelites, and very much in the control of God. The Israelites were to follow the pillar of the cloud by day and the fire by night. So really, they were following. God was controlling where they went, and they were following. And by doing this, following the cloud and the fire, they departed from the normal route out of Egypt, and they effectively got themselves in a position where they were trapped, with mountains on two sides, the sea on the other, and the Egyptian armies on the fourth side. Except, of course, they weren't trapped, because this was exactly what God had intended. As the Egyptians approached, just before the sea opened up, the pillar of the cloud and the fire that had been leading them at this point moved around and stood between them and the Egyptian army, and effectively held the Egyptian army back from doing anything. After they crossed through the sea, and the seas closed over the Egyptian armies, when the Israelites looked back and saw the bodies of the Egyptian soldiers floating in the water, they finally had left Egypt behind. Only problem was, they hadn't left Egypt behind in their minds. God continued to lead them with the cloud and the pillar of fire for the next 40 years. But that entire period of time, the Israelites continually looked back to Egypt, to an imagined pleasant time there. And it was imagined, because they lost sight of the reality that while they were in Egypt, they'd been slave people living under oppression and under fear. There's a continuing message for us today. We've come out of the world. We know Egypt is a type of this world. And just as God called Israel out of the land of Egypt, he called us out of this world. In a sense, he calls us out of our own personal Egypt. We each of us have, we all see the world in unique ways. We have our own personal views about what's good, what's bad, what's acceptable, what's unacceptable. We've all been called to physically, well, not leave, I was going to say leave this world, but we haven't been called to leave the world, but we've been called to leave our previous world view, our way of looking at the world. How often do we look back and maybe imagine how things, well, they might have been? But does our imagining and our reality actually match up? In the history of Israel in Egypt, before they left Egypt, before and after, really, you never find a time when they completely rejected God. Instead, you find a history of trying to incorporate the worship of the gods of people around them, combine it somehow in with worshipping the true God. Of course, it's not going to work. The history of Israel involves the people who want, at least to a degree, some kind of relationship with God. But yet, at the same time, they want to incorporate worship with other gods, gods that are obviously at variance with the true God. I think perhaps we can empathise with the Israelites when you consider what they went through. The descendants of Israel had come to Egypt during a time of great famine. God had revealed to Jacob that they could go to Egypt. He could take his family there, and God would bring him back from Egypt to the promised land at an appointed time in the future. In the first years in Egypt, life was good. The Israelites occupied a prosperous part of the land, the area of Goshen, rich pasture land, and they were prosperous. They were doing well. But with the coming of a new Pharaoh after Joseph had died, their lives changed dramatically. So let's just go back to Exodus 1 and remind ourselves of what it was like and what it tells us about these people. So I said at the beginning, let's try to get into the mind of the average Israelite living through these times and try to visualize what they were going through. In Exodus chapter 1, in verse 6, and Joseph died and all his brethren and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty. The land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. So the regime changed a bit. People began to forget about what had happened in the time of Joseph. And he said to his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it comes to pass that when there fall out any at war, they join also with our enemies, and they fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. So they were seen as a threat. They lived in one of the best parts of Egypt, and there was rather a lot of them. More, in fact, than there were Egyptians, they're saying here. Therefore, verse 11, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All of their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. And as the account continues, we find that Pharaoh commanded that the Israelite male babies should be thrown into the Nile, most likely to drown, or alternatively be eaten by crocodiles. And we know about crocodiles from Mr. Torselli. They're not only in Australia, they also a lot of them in the Nile, especially at that time. But the account does actually indicate that the midwives exercised compassion, and probably a lot of that part of the command from Pharaoh wasn't carried out that often. Of course, we know of Moses. He, potentially, his mother realized the danger, and he was saved from that possible fate. Anyway, it's clear that the life of the Israelite slave was very harsh, very painful. While the Pharaoh acted really out of fear of the Israelites, the Egyptians as a whole were actually well-respected people throughout the world at that time, or the known world. Egypt was the centre of education, the centre of commerce in the ancient world. These were people who constructed the pyramids. Many other marvels that were still impressive nearly 4,000 years later. 4,000 years is a long time for building to survive. You know, this country, we've got lots of ancient buildings, more than most countries, I think, but except maybe for Greece, of course. But very few in this country go back over 1,000 years. We have near us the remains of a Roman city. Now, that is getting on for coming up for 2,000 years old. But there's very little left of it, outside the ruins of a city wall and the ruined amphitheatre. Technology of the Egyptian engineers wasn't really equaled until maybe the last couple hundred years. Other aspects as well, the dyes they use in paintings, they've survived thousands of years in the desert climate. And the Egyptians were in many ways benevolent, generous people. They regularly provided food and even monetary help to nations around them while they were suffering. fact, you could say, if we'd lived back at that time, it probably got on okay with the Egyptians. Maybe you'd think of them as, well, they're decent people. Of course, they did have this slave thing with the Israelites. But then, if we check our own country's history, go back 200-300 years, what do we find? Britain was probably the major player in a thriving slave trade, which continued to flourish even after slavery was actually abolished in this country itself. And really, Britain had less excuse. Britain was a nation that called itself Christian. It had freely available the Bible. In fact, the exact translation that I'm reading from, the King James Version, had been available to the slave traders at that time for 150 years. But if we checked out the Israelites at the time of the Egyptians, they were slave people, poorly educated, sheep herders, manual labourers, who did menial work, making clay bricks in the hot sun. Now, I'm not saying it was their fault, but that was the situation. There's no record of that time of any kind of cultural activity for them. No education system, no economic system, not even any writings that survived from that period. Well over 100 years or more of slavery can pretty well crush the culture out of anybody. So if you were actually a traveller in Egypt at that time, you might be a little bit uncomfortable the way that these people, these Israelites, conducted themselves. No doubt the people of Israel heard about a special god. But that was a little bit in the past. It was one that made promises to their ancestors. They probably knew that God had promised to bring them back from Egypt to the promised land. But over 200 years had passed since they entered Egypt, and as best as they could tell, God was really quite silent for all that time. In the world of that day, it was believed there were many gods, all of whom ruled over specific areas of land or specific natural phenomena. Since they lived in Egypt, it was only logical for them to worship gods that were worshipped there. But yes, they probably still did pray to that special god, the God of Israel. He was their god, and if he ever did get powerful enough to release them from slavery, it'd be nice to be on good terms with him. But for the most part, they were living in a society that worshipped multiple gods, and they were believing pretty much what those people believed then. Probably the Egyptians and the Israelites who lived among them believed that the Egyptian gods ruled in that area. This God of Israel couldn't be as powerful as the Egyptian gods. It's logical, after all, because not in this area. Because for decade after decade, he hadn't got to get them out of there. So the Egyptian gods, stands to reason, must have been more powerful. And the Egyptians had many gods. The god of the river Nile, god of the weather, gods that protected them from plagues, gods of the harvest, gods of the dead, gods of the sun, gods of the moon, the stars. Pharaoh himself was not quite a god, very nearly one. Worshipping all these gods would seem normal. It was what everyone did in Egypt. So it seemed perfectly acceptable, maybe even desirable. After all, it's a hard life being a slave, and an Egyptian religious festival would bring a little bit of relief from the daily drudgery of being a slave. So why not participate? Why not be a part of it? It would at least give you a bit of a break. That being said, it wouldn't hurt to pray every once in a while to this God of Israel that they knew had been there a while ago, and maybe one of these days he might be there to help his people again. I think there's something about the human mind that can adopt to circumstances. Even those living in horrendous conditions in concentration camps in the last war, they could adapt to a degree, perhaps bring a certain sense of order to their surroundings, and by doing that, some of them did survive. And no doubt the Israelites, to a degree, adopted their way of life as slaves to the Egyptians. In a sense, they may not have wanted things to alter, because every time something altered, things got worse. When God began to work to bring Israel out of Egypt, there were certain things he had to prove before Israel would be able to follow him. Because it could have been so easy, really. He could have just changed the heart of the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh would have said, fine, let the Israelites go. Or he could have let Egypt be defeated by another nation, and then both the Egyptians and the Israelites would probably have said, well, gods of this new nation are more powerful than Egyptian gods. And they maybe could start beginning to worship them too. But for Israel to follow the true God, God needed to prove to them that he was more powerful, mightier than all the other gods together. Turn to Exodus 12. This is part of the first Passover instruction. And in verse 12, there's a phrase that is easy to read right over. Exodus 12, verse 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. God is saying, I am the Lord. I am the Almighty God. There's no God beside him. And he mentions against all the gods of Egypt. God is saying that he's not some imagined God, but he's the real God. God's identifying himself as unique to these people, the Israelites. He says, I'm going to execute judgment on all the gods of Egypt. Some Jewish writers have suggested, as well as the firstborn, all the idols of Egypt were destroyed that night. While this might be the case, the Bible doesn't actually confirm this, apart from this phrase, and against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. However, there would seem to be grounds to suppose that each of the 10 plagues was directed explicitly towards different gods that were worshipped by the Egyptians. The god of the Nile couldn't restore fresh water when Israel's god turned to blood. The gods of the harvest couldn't protect the crops from the locusts or the hail. The gods of the weather couldn't protect Egypt from the massive hailstones that God sent. The mighty sun god couldn't dispel the darkness that covered Egypt. It didn't touch the land of Goshen, the Israelites were fine. Pharaoh himself finally had to acknowledge the power of Israel's God and release the people. It was important to know, for the Egyptians to know, that this God of Israel was more powerful than all their gods together. But it was far more important for Israel to know that too. Israel needed to know that their God was God. Until they were thoroughly convinced of that, they would never willingly give up their worship of the many gods and worship only the true God. And this is what God planned to do. If we turn to Exodus 13. Exodus 13, verse 17. This is after the plagues have come and they're on their way out. And it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war, and they return to Egypt. The way God led them wasn't the obvious route to the promised land. Far from it. The shortest route would have been the northern route along the coast, but that would have led them towards the Philistines, potential war and discouragement for the newly freed people. Verse 18. But God led the people through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up harnessed out of the land of Egypt. So instead God led them down to the wilderness. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones away hence from you. And he took their journey from Succoth and encamped in Ethan on the edge of the wilderness. They'll be moving slowly with old people, children, animals, but it looks like they also kept moving most of the time, night as well as day, which is partly why they had the pillar of fire. And then in Exodus 14, God tells them to camp at a very specific location. Exodus 14 verse 2. Speak to the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Parahoth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal Zephon. Before it you shall encamp by the sea. So the exact locations of these places mentioned in this verse, which does actually give very exactly the point that the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, hasn't been possibly identified. Various experts have suggested a number of different locations. But whatever way it was, it, physically speaking, didn't look a good position for the Israelites. Two sides lay mountains, before them was the Red Sea, and on the other side was the Egyptian army, ready to destroy them. Both they and the Egyptians assumed that they were trapped. If we look in continue in verse 3, Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land, the wilderness has sucked them in. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he shall follow after them, and I will be honored among the Pharaoh and upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And we all know what happened next. God divided the sea and led the people safely through it. God worked what would be thought to be an absolutely impossible miracle and rescued his people. The Egyptians had been held back by God, placing the plague and the pillar of fire between them and the Israelites, and now this was removed, and the Egyptian chariots charged into the pathway between the walls of the water. As the Israelites reached the far side of the sea, the walls of water came crashing down on the Egyptians, destroying the core of what was probably the most powerful army on the face of the earth at that time. And for the first time for well over 100 years, the people of Israel were free. For a moment there was great rejoicing. Chapter 15 describes it. But it doesn't take long before things start to sour. Let's move on to Exodus 15, verse 22. Exodus 15 verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and he went out into the wilderness of Shur, and he went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they couldn't drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? So it didn't take long. But of course, in a desert, water is a pretty urgent need. You're not going to survive very long without it. Verse 25, and he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree which he had cast into the water, and the waters were made sweet. And there he made them a statue and an ordinance, and there he proved them. So the people had just been miraculously delivered from their Egyptian oppression, but they may well have still viewed their God with the same limitations that they applied to the Egyptian gods. They're in a different land now. God can't provide for us. But he's a local God. Yeah. This is why immediately the water, well, what are we going to drink? They've just seen they're being delivered by through the Red Sea, but 3 days later, we need water. Can God do that? There's something that happened time and time again through the history of Israel. And the attitude is summed up in Psalm 78. If we turn to Psalm 78. The psalm describes the history of Israel and the way they conducted themselves. If we go on to Psalm 78, verse 40. How often did they provoke him in the wilderness and grieve him in the desert? And then verse 41 makes what you may call a key statement. Yes, they turned back and tempted God, and they limited the Holy One of Israel. This is perhaps the principal problem that the Israelites had. And it's a problem that it's so easy to have in our own lives. They limited God, and we, in our own minds, can so easily limit God. The psalm continues detailing the miracles that the Israelites had witnessed as God prepared them to leave Egypt. Verse 42, they remembered not his hand, nor the day when he delivered them from the enemy. How he wrought his signs in Egypt, and his wonders in the field of Zion, and had turned their rivers into blood, and their floods that they could not drink. And he sent diverse sorts of flies among them, and devoured them, and frogs which destroyed them, and he gave also their increase unto the caterpillar, and their labour unto the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail, and their sycamore trees with frost. He gave up their cattle also unto the hail, and their flocks to hot thunderbolts. He cast upon them the fierceness of his anger, wrath and indignation and trouble by sending evil angels among them. And he made a way to his anger. He spared not their soul from death, but gave their life over to the pestilence. And smote all the firstborn in Egypt, the chief of their strength and the tabernacle of Ham. But made his own people to go forth like sheep, and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. So, what they were doing, basically they were seeing God in the same way that the Egyptians viewed their numerous gods. Gods of limited power, specialist gods if you like, God of the river, God of the harvest. You name it, there was probably a God that specialised in that aspect of life. It just seemed normal to think of God within those limits. It was the Egyptian way of thinking, a way which the Israelites had experienced really all their lives. Those that left with the Exodus, they'd been slaves all their lives, they'd been in the Egyptian society all their lives. So they continued. A few weeks later, God brought them to the foot of Mount Sinai. And he spoke directly to the people with his commandments. The Israelites agreed to follow God's instructions, made a covenant, an agreement with him, and he promised to bless them for their obedience. Moses went up the mountain to receive the two tablets of stone, written by God's own fingers. And while he's gone, the Israelites showed the mindset that they used when they were in Egypt. If we go back to Exodus 32. Exodus 32, in verse 1, and when the people saw that Moses delayed to come out of the mount, the people gathered themselves up unto Aaron and said to him, up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up and out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. Of course, Moses was actually gone for 40 days. So maybe after 3 or 4 weeks, he'd gone up the mountain, not come back. Maybe they did begin to wonder if he's ever going to come back. And Aaron said to them in verse 2, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring them to me. And all the people broke off the golden earrings that were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool, and after he had made it, a molten calf. They said, these be your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Here they weren't saying that the idol itself was God. They were saying, in effect, here is the representation of your God. This is what your God's like. This idol shows you your God. And verse 5, when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And God said to Moses, go get down, for your people, which you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I have commanded them, They made them a molten calf and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed unto it, and said, These be your gods, O Israel, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt. So, why would they make an image like a calf, beside that was what God was like? You have to think about it. Cows aren't actually the brightest of animals. You know, they are very curious. You know, if you stand by the fence, they come over and look at you. But, you know, just out of curiosity, really. But compared to, say, a dog or a horse, they are actually fairly stupid. But, so why choose a cow? Well, it's because of the way things were done in Egypt. Many of the Egyptian gods were depicted as bulls, oxen, and cows. I've got here an extract from the church's Bible reading program, referring to the gods of Egypt. And so, as in most pagan societies, oxen had strong attachments to various deities in Egypt. Apis, the bull god, was the living personification of the creation god. The creator sun god, Atum and Re, later were syncretized into a single deity, were represented by the black bull. Menevus, I think that would be. Nut and Neith were both depicted as great celestial cows who gave birth to the cosmos and other deities. Another goddess was associated with creation and was depicted as a cow. The mother goddess, Hathor and Nekhbet, were both pictured with the form of a cow. Heset, the goddess of birth, was depicted as a cow. And the foster mother of Horus, the cow goddess Sekhet Hor, was even invoked to safeguard cattle. So they had a cow god to look after the cattle as well. But gods were depicted as cattle, or many of the gods were, and it would seem normal to the Israelites. They would be looking back to how it was done in Egypt. And the thinking would be, well, you know, we had sacred bulls there, you know, things we begged down to, everyone did it. It's been that way for hundreds of years. It just seems normal, right. Instead of coming to know and trust the true God, they look back on how things were done in Egypt. But God continued to work with them to help them understand who or what he was. He revealed himself in many ways. He provided water in the middle of the wilderness. He gave them manna 6 days a week, double on the sixth day, none on the Sabbath. But they also continued to hang on to their old concepts about God, because that seemed normal. God brought them to the border of the promised land, and he offered to let them go in to take possession. Just a few months down the line, 12 spies were sent out to look at the land, one from each tribe. Two of them, Joshua and Caleb, came out with a very positive report of what the land was like and how abundant it was. They were in effect saying, yeah, we can do this, we can take the land, God's opened the door. We can go and take this land. But the other 10 spies said, oh no, can't do that. No, there's giants there. We were like grasshoppers at their sight. We can't possibly overcome them. And just shortly before, God had parted the Red Sea for them and effectively destroyed the most powerful nation on earth. But by comparison, these are just a collection of little city-states. God had brought them to the border and gave them the opportunity to go to the promised land. But the people preferred to listen to the bad report of the 10 spies, decided that God wasn't strong enough to take them into the land. We read this in Numbers 14. Numbers 14 in verse 1. This is just after they had heard this report.